Thank you. I guess I need a cup and tea bag too. I'm bothering me. If staff on either side can help us in these budgets, some of them are going into pretty cold, and you have the background. Why, please do so. And I don't know is that the, but any staff, anybody you want, Senator Adams, of course, bring to the table anytime. We're in the commissions, boards, Council of State Arts, and so on. And I, if anybody's here to testify in that area, please come forward. Thank you. I guess I need a
cup.
Thanks. Oh, okay, I will let you. It is dirty. You may identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Christine Darcy. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. Shall I just start?
Please go ahead. We do have some questions. Particular one, of course, is how has the governor's veto of the general fund match affected your program? Did you lose federal funds after, you know, we put in that extra funding so that you were, federal funding was available? But go ahead and make any statement you want.
Okay, and then why don't I address that at the end? The Arts Council was established in 1966. We're a quasi-independent board within the Department of Education. Policy is established and grants are awarded by an 11-member board appointed by the governor.
Could I have a copy for the record of all the grants you've awarded this year to whom?
Yes, there.
I don't have to have them now, just okay. If you will.
Okay. We are primarily a grant-making agency at this juncture. We fund both individuals and arts organizations and Alaskan schools through 10 different grant programs. We also provide other programs and services which are not offered by other agencies within state government or by independent nonprofits. We consider our funding and activity to be catalytic in terms of overall arts activity that occurs within the state of Alaska. I think that you have all received copies of an economic impact study on Alaska's arts industry that the council completed in May of 1991, which conservatively estimated a $23 million arts industry. One of the figures that I found amazing in that report was that interest in the arts in Alaska is so keen that attendance figures of 1.8 million accounted for almost every man, woman, and child attending three arts events during the course of a year. Our budget is made up of general fund and federal funding. Our federal funding comes from the National Endowment for the Arts through a variety of their grant programs. We are not proposing major significant differences in our programming going into FY93. We have two transfers within our adjusted base, which essentially correct how we are reporting on actual spending. We are moving, we're proposing the movement of funds from grants and claims to personal services to fully fund our Native Arts Program Director position, which remained vacant until late in FY91. That person has been extremely effective in our agency and someone that we feel is critical to providing services to rural Alaska. The other transfer within our adjusted base is from grants to contractual to appropriately reflect the spending of those funds via a professional services contract rather than via a grant. Mr. Chairman, you asked for some clarification of the changes from the FY92 Conference Committee to FY92 authorized on page 89 of the short form book.
That was before you handed in your resignation. We thought we'd ask you that.
Shall I go on? we were very happy that the legislature added money to the Arts Council's budget at the conference committee level last year. And we, at the time, were trying to restore some funds that had been previously cut. We were trying to increase our arts and education activity. And we were trying to increase our cash match for a rural arts development grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. The governor, and I do think that the budget book is a little misleading, the governor did veto all of those increments.
You're not trying again.
We're always trying. I think that I think that the council, as part of the administration, is following the direction from OMB in terms of not requesting increased funding. I can tell you that if you speak to the arts constituency within the state, there is never enough money.
Sure. That's not unique to that subject.
I agree with that.
Well, did you lose federal funding then?
No, we did not lose federal funding.
Just once more, thanks. We increased by COLA and then backed COLA back up, is that right?
Right.
And that what the hell is the purpose of that?
I would feel more comfortable if someone from the department answered that question.
They may.
Mr. Chairman, the department, in including the COLA within the budget, decided that in some areas, different divisions could absorb the COLA. In other areas, we took programmatic cuts to be able to include the COLA.
You took programmatic cuts?
Yes.
In order
we made cuts, specific cuts to the budget to be able to include the COLA within the departmental budget. And this was in one particular area where we thought that the program could assume the cost of the COLA next year.
So initially you introduced it, and then you reduced it in this particular component, and
right.
You said they could eat it. You didn't look for reduction in wages or anything else, you looked just to reduce the COLA.
Right.
Are there any questions? You have the floor, Senator.
Am I to read this? The only federal receipt funds of $675,000, the only general fund match is necessary is $50,000?
No, we are going into the third year of a special federal grant involving 5 local arts councils in Alaska communities. And for accounting purposes, because that is a 3-way matching program on a federal, state, and local level, we have to identify the match clearly in our budget documents. A great deal of our general fund dollars are used as federal match.
What percentage then would we need to put in the budget in general fund dollars in order to meet that federal match? Out of the $1.8 million?
I think you're looking at a pretty close number. I may be able to, I would probably need to get clarification on that. We receive about 6 different federal grants, and we apply for them on some on a competitive basis. So in some cases, the match is more than 1-to-1, and that's the case with this local grant in the $50,000 in the third year. But some of our grants are matched 1-to-1. Some of our grants have a larger match requirement, and I would be happy to get you a list of those federal grants if that would help answer the question.
That would, Mr. Chairman. If we're going to make reductions throughout the operating budget, it would be necessary that we have that information. I appreciate it.
Yeah, may as well give it to the whole committee. All members of finance are members of this subcommittee. We've explained COLA. Are there questions of this person and this program at this time? Well, that was down and dirty. Thank you very much. I really think that art program provides a cottage industry also, or that is extremely important. It could bring in a lot more than just the amount. It just depends on marketing, but I think it'd bring in a lot more than just the $23 million we're talking about, too.
That was a conservative estimate.
I've been reading where cottage industries covering many things besides just the art programs, but in the urban areas, small states and urban, near urban areas, i.e. Vermont, New Hampshire, so on, these cottage industries are huge, hundreds of millions of dollars, where they have a market. And I wouldn't wonder, but the West Coast, certainly greater Los Angeles and so on, there's an area there that can't even be tapped to provide some of these quality art products. could steal ivory, kill elephants. Alaska post-secondary education, that's the main function. Anybody that wishes to come forward with the director, please do so. The trip down to your program, I think, is resembling the arts program.
Thank you.
And that's pretty scary, too. You can explain your budget in any way you wish to introduce it, and we have several questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Alan Barnes. I'm the Executive Director of the Post-Secondary Commission, and with me is Kevin Hannon, who's our Finance Director, and in the audience is Diane Behrens, who is our Program Officer. I think the young lady passed out a short booklet. I'd like to take a moment to go through it.
If either of you have any questions that are going to help us, and the committee doesn't, has exhausted their questioning or thinks they need it, please chime in.
Mr. Chairman, on page one, it's just an outline of the post-secondary commission. We're governed by a 14-member board appointed by the governor. We also, in the student loan program, have a 5-member corporation board. We're largely responsible for looking after post-secondary education in terms of authorization of institutions.
Do you charge for reviews of these post-secondary educations? Do you charge for that review of their competence? Do you break even on that review?
An application fee
of, I believe, it's $100.
What?
An application fee of $100 to authorize for authorization to operate from Alaska.
But that obviously doesn't pay for the cost of checking to see if it has any competence or anything. It's just an application fee.
It is to, yes.
There seems to be quite a push now to increase state collections of services performed for institutions of all sorts. And
Senator, I think this fee is rather to discourage nuisance kinds of processes. It is to determine a person's pretty serious about seeking authorization. $100 seems to be a reasonable figure.
Banks used to think that was a reasonable figure to audit and look over their shoulder, too, you know. Please proceed.
Our functions are listed in the summary of those are listed on page one. I think the four major areas that you would be most familiar with, again, is the authorization and consumer protection, certainly the Alaska Student Loan Program, and then we administer the WICHE and the WAMI programs. And page two is an outline of the way the organization is divided up between the post-secondary functions and the student loan operations.
What about this question that you bring to mind when I see the student loan operations and the student phoning and hitting a reporting and phoning and hitting yet another and those problems of ever getting attention in any reasonable period of time by a long distance to whatever their specific request or question is? What's happening there?
I think what we've discovered with the implementation of the new computer system, and I don't think that's the whole reason for phone delay. That has been sort of endemic to the loan program for years, back in 85, 84, when my son attended.
We had lots of trouble last year for the first time.
That's true. We've discovered now that the loan mix-up on the phones is largely on a surge related to billings. We're sending out approximately 50,000 bills every month, much like a master charge billing, whereas prior to this, they were paying, the student would pay on coupons.
Okay, are you covering it so the student can get direct response to their question above the surge of billing?
We are now in less than a week turnaround on callbacks, which we were back 6 weeks before. If you called us, left a message, we might get back to you in 6 weeks. So we've definitely seen a reduction in the callback time.
Write that down for the week turnaround.
Now, if you call us right in the middle of a surge, which will happen, let's say, this Wednesday, and we'll have a one-week surge, then all bets are off. It stretches up to two weeks. But during the, for
example, can you, in your surge of putting out information, let the students know a one-time only in their billings or whatever that... I suppose it's actually those that are recipients of funding more than those that are billings, but I'm not sure of that. I just know we've had a lot of, we did have a lot of problems. I don't know how many we've had recently.
Some of it has been, a great deal of it has been worked out. We increased through temporaries. We have a 50% increase in phone staff. They've been operating since the first of the year.
You're trying to assist. You need more help there?
For the short term, we certainly do. And we have, that's been provided through a supplemental request, which is on page 3.
Is the supplemental request already in House Bill 470? Or one of the pieces?
It's in one of the pieces. It's in the governor's request.
And that is specifically for assisting in this whole area?
It is. There were approximately 5% of the 70,000 loans that came across an error. So a number of the temporaries are working to repair those errors online, going through elaborate screen operations. It takes a couple of hours for each repair. And then the other temporaries are working with phones to handle a surge. Can we figure out whether the surge is just an anomaly because people are unfamiliar with getting billings, or whether this is going to be a permanent part of the loan program, in which case
glitches really hurt students, particularly if they're expecting funding for some reason is being held up by an institution that's screwed up or led themselves. Even these facts would be desperate.
With this
and I know that. I have memories of that myself. So. And with no loan program much available, but I can tell you, we meant the weekends without any food, you know, and we don't need to make it, but that isn't really what we're going to do.
We successfully issued 6,000 warrants this Christmas. To all those borrowers who had completed the paperwork properly. That was on time. And those that didn't get it was because they hadn't either signed a promissory note or completed a loan application. I think the program is working very well.
If I had to pay you, I wouldn't be rushing to find out why I couldn't get through the phone to help. If I needed the money, it would be the other way around. So I hope you'll be watching these guys still in school.
We have skip chasers, and they chase those guys.
That ought to be the direction. I mean, we don't exist to collect. We exist to provide a service. The collection becomes a necessity. Well, you're saying then, I'll quit it. It was 6 weeks, and now it's a week. If we're lucky.
I'd say if you're in the middle of the surge, it'll be more like a 2-week turnaround. But generally speaking, we're back to them. In some cases, it's 3 or 4 days.
It's really hard for me to believe that should be that way. But, Dana, it's still hard for us to believe it. Guy should do more than the phone all day long, not be able to get through. That's real. I hope you, I don't know, I haven't listened to your recordings now, but I hope they full well know that you're going to be calling back and you're going to be a week before you call back or some damn thing so they don't spend long distance calls day after day trying to get through.
I hear you. We've had the phone service, we've had the phone company come in.
Well, I have no doubt you're trying to help. I mean, I'm not entirely harassing you. I'm between you and them, and you're between us and OMB, probably, et cetera. But, boy, I've got a number of calls, although I can't say I have in the last couple of weeks. I'd have to go back and check with office staff.
It's definitely fine.
We tried ourselves, you know, and it was really frustrating.
It is frustrating. And on the surge, you can not only get caught into that messaging system, you can get a business.
And you have to remember, this is our only time of year that we get to express ourselves on any of these things. Please proceed.
On page 3, I have indicated the budget supplemental. We hope we'll get some support through your committee and the Senate and the House.
If you're asking for a supplemental now, what is the rationale for reducing this operating budget?
Decrement
doesn't save money for the general fund.
We put a decrement of approximately $170,000 forward at the request of Office of Management and Budget, and we have just recently rescheduled.
What do you mean $170,000 forward?
If you go to page 4, cost of living adjustments / decrement highlights, that's what I'm referring to. And we've asked OMB to meet with them on Monday to reconsider that decremental effort. In short, we're going to try to see if we can get that out of our budget for FY93. I think all agencies and divisions were required to absorb a COLA, and this was our effort here. And now, after we did this right, I was only on the job a day. Now I've been there 3 months. Kevin is back working with his finance director. We're pretty much convinced that this would be a real detriment to our FY93 operation.
Ask these questions right here. Yeah.
to go on.
Excuse me.
Okay, you answered part of the question about the reduction in corporate receipts and what impact does that have, and what it has if you don't add to the general fund. The other part of that question is, does it go into more loans for students if you reduce your budget, or what?
Sure, we would have more, if we reduce the budget, there would be more money to make loans. However, we're not at a point where we're turning anyone down.
And then the other part of the question is the 10 million.
You don't lapse funds, you don't buy
less bonds.
We buy less bonds. We issue less bonds. Excuse me, I didn't hear you.
Please proceed.
Okay, on page 3, I'll just look over the various program categories, program administration, student loan operations. I don't know if there's any questions on WICHE or WAMI.
I'm not sure. I've got programs here. Yes, sir.
I had a question on the, you've got the student loan program divided into at least a couple, maybe three sub-program areas. What are you calling program administration in your budget sub-program?
It's largely the commission activity, the administrative activity, the finance activity, veterans approval. We have about $150,000 that comes for supervision of that program. Our loan compliance, people who go out and actually monitor post-secondary institutions to be sure that they're spending the money the way they said they were going to spend it. Are they really a legitimate operation and not just ripping off the state?
Okay. Well, when you, in your, you spend in that sub-program $568,000 of your total $746 in corporate receipts. Is that the student loan corporate receipts, or are there other kinds of corporate receipts?
It would all be student loan corporate. There's only one set of corporate receipts.
Well, in looking through your chart here, you've got, like you said, VA programs, administrative assistant. You've got a number of functions here. Are those all related or mostly related to the student loan operation? I mean, to the state student loan operation?
The commission itself, its funding comes from corporation receipts. There are no general funds that support the Alaska Post-Secondary Commission. It comes from corporation receipts.
Well, you've lost me. The commission, you mean this whole area?
Right.
Because that's not true. I mean, you've got federal funds, and you've got some general funds for WICHE and WAMI.
Right.
And so what part are you talking about? I mean, all the people and the operations portion?
You'd have to take out the Veterans Approval Agency is federally funded, and the career or the vocational counselor is federally funded. Other than that, yes, it's funded from corporation receipts.
Okay, this didn't happen just yesterday, or it's kind of crept up.
Nothing new.
I'm trying to rationalize why we would have allowed a student loan bond-based corporation assets to be used for commission travel and meetings for the 14 commissioners. If presumably they've got a laundry list of duties and roles other than running the student loan component, why are all these other functions being funded with corporate receipts?
I'd like to turn around and look at somebody behind me because I don't know.
Well, please come forward. I've got so many minutes.
It's all directly related. I mean, it goes to pay the institutional authorization function, for example, where we've got employees that go out and review the colleges and universities as well as the vocational schools as far as curriculum goes. The 14-member board of directors of the commission primarily spend, Alan can probably speak to this better than I can, primarily spend most of their time on student loan issues.
It's the biggest function that the commission would work with is the student loan program. And 79 of the people who work in the commission, if you will, are assigned to student loan operations. And the loan program is a vehicle for the commission to ensure that there are, you know, adequate educational opportunities. So it's kind of a hand-in-glove type thing.
Mr. Chairman, here's how it comes back the other way, though. For a long time, there have been critics of the commission say, why do you need this 14-member commission? Why are they spending all this money just to meet and travel and administration? The response typically has been, we do a lot more than just student loans. We look at our K-12 policies and how that integrates with post-secondary education and, a whole wide range of issues. Well, I'm uncomfortable with funding a lot of other functions with Student Loan Corporation proceeds because and I know you've received this lecture at least three times before, but if we don't receive...
Coming up again, too.
Yeah. Now do I take my shoe off or what?
Yeah, if the administration refuses to fund a general fund component and we're really in the bonds, I mean, big time, we're going to be issuing bonds to pay for a function of government outside the student loan program. And that doesn't make sense. And I wouldn't want to see
borrowing money for operations.
Right.
I think in one sense, it's probably the cost of doing business. If you want to restructure the commission and the loan program, separate it out, that's a policy decision that the administrators are not going to start working on without some direction from either the governor's office or commissioners or the legislature. And I don't have an answer for you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one answer, maybe that's what you implied, one answer is you have a much smaller commission and they are the Student Loan Corporation Commission, and that's what they do, and this thing collapses a little bit, this chart, and that is their function. They are funded through corporation receipts and federal funds to the extent that there are federal programs, and we not worry about having 14-member commissions and having a lot of these maybe theoretical goals and objectives that may be in statute even that aren't the reality of what they work on.
Senator, go ahead.
Senator, I think, again, my limited time, I have two jobs. One is I'm the executive director of the Alaska Student Loan Corporation. One, I'm the executive director of the Post-Secondary Commission. I've had enough experience with both of them to tell you that if you want a broad-based Alaska representation to manage this program, your best bet is the 14-member commission. Because the way the corporation board is set up, it's three members in the administration and two off the commission. It seems to me that the best interest of the broadest field, this commission serves a very valued purpose, and I feel real strongly about that. There are people from the private sector, there are people from the higher education system, from Board of Regents. It really is a cross-section of people with a vested interest in post-secondary ed, and this is an awful lot of money that the loan program addresses.
What you're saying is you're not getting support out of the administration. But you are getting it out of, no matter who may sit there, when it's broad enough spectrum of citizens, you're getting that support out of the citizens. They understand it.
There's a broader constituency within that commission than you get from, just by the nature of the way the program
works. Why should we pay for it the way we're paying? That's the question.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's sort of been a historical... I think it's been that way always. You did not fund, as far as I know, you did not fund a separate set of money for the commission. So I've been out of, there was considerable more program money. But when Kerry Ronsberg was here, if we gave him $60 million, he probably took four off the top to operate the commission. This is not something, this has been going on for 20 years. Maybe it's time to look at it, but I don't think this is a new situation.
Mr. Chairman, when things get tough, I mean, this is the kind of thing we need to look at. I'd add it to the
I'm reading your mind. We need the student loan portion. The other, they tell me, actually, it was like Kishimoto answering a previous question, that when the state of Alaska started asking about post-secondary program, it was already being abandoned by many other states, and that was clear back during the time of Alan Byrne and Jeannie Chance. That's a long time ago. We had some real battles on this. Senator Adams.
Yes,
sir. How much money can we save?
We can save quite a bit. It's one, I hate to be on the other side of every issue, but this is an area I feel that you can, if we're going to cut something out of administration, this is the area you're going to have to do it on. And my reasons behind it is the only valuable services that post-secondary today provides is a loan program. And if you go back and look at the statutes under the Alaska Statute 1442.030, the functions, what this commission has to do, it says to develop a competent plan for orderly systematic growth of public and private secondary element, Education. Why did we set up the Board of Education? That is their particular functions. That you can continue on, advice to the function and purpose of the colleges and the university. You have the Board of Regents. You have other people providing these particular services. So if you went through all the functions, these functions, I don't believe, are being met by post-secondary education. You can debate me on those. The only area here is the loan program. And I believe if you're ready to do it at some point, that you're going to have to consolidate when the revenues drop is in Department of Commerce with the loan programs. Even if there is 50,000 bills that go over, glitches, I think we need to look at these very closely, Mr. Chairman. So, that's where I come from as far
there
as...
There is the whammy and witchy
there is
program that have values. But other than that, that in the loan program could provide him with the responsibility, but it wouldn't be as broad as the other. Senator, you have the floor, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, I thought you were... I don't want... That's all I have
okay.
on this particular topic.
At the very end, I want to discuss the lack of funding, state funding in that whole program for scholarship loans. But please proceed. What we're used to, and I'm going to ask your Deputy Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner, to try to work off our blue book, because until we get really knowledgeable about these issues with once a year introductions, I am working back and forth against this. I think both these senators are a little handier in doing so than I am. They've been closer to the budget in the immediate past than I have. So I really get confused when I try to work from the blue book, what little information is there back to these. You have the floor, Senator Adams.
Just one more thing. It's very easy for me to sit here and say we need to do these things. But one of the things that's the hardest part of anything where your reductions or changes or even direction, that needs a statutory change in many times in these. And so, I mean, if we're going to do something, then we've got to get it ready to do on a master plan at this particular time, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I think we're going to have to sit down very shortly with funds available, supplementals available and needed, and funds we're going to expend. And at that moment, it's going to be absolutely... And you're right, probably the varying subcommittees will have to make suggested as part of the responsibility success to statutory change to accomplish their suggestions and reduction in some cases. Please proceed, Mr. Director.
Maybe I'm going to finish up with this little sheet here. Like I will.
I can follow the sheet. I can't get it back to where I kept my notes, so I don't know how to ask questions.
I think we pretty much covered everything. Just for your information, the very last item on page 4 is the 13,000 new borrowers, lending out $55 million this year. Our annualized default rate is much improved than the efforts that you folks made 3 years ago by adding to the loan services grant. And that's our general presentation. If you have questions on the blue book, we have a copy, and we'll be delighted.
Yeah, the floor is on that.
On the student's loans with the bonding, we had placed, was it $10 million, and there was $4 million vetoed. The effect of that veto, please.
I would say in the long term, the effect, if I'm not mistaken, will be if that sustains itself. For example, there's no funds requested for the coming year. There will be a definite impact on the ability of the Alaska Student Loan Program to meet demand. If the demand for loans increases over the next 10 years, say an average of 2% or more, you will be at a point where you will have to go to some kind of a need-based program, restructure your debt, not to mention the amount of debt that you'll incur over the next 10 years will be double what you would if you were able to provide general fund monies.
I'd like a letter on that, our request, will double. I think those are things that
you'll be getting at the
we
end
need,
of this week.
We really need to let the legislature know when they make decisions. Last year it was reduced to 4, this year to 0. And really what terrifies me is the fact that was a 0 when we were funding a very liberal budget. It's not 0 under the present facts of life.
No. As you know, the Financial Council is here. We have a letter and a millennium update coming in the middle of this week, which we'll forward to you on this. Rachel is expecting a copy as well. Each member of the Senate Finance will get a copy of the with the analysis of the two policy considerations, general fund versus continued funding. You have to kind of read it, and you can see to the uninitiated, it may not make much sense, but those who have looked at that little box and how the Edison Dodge put this together, it's real clear by the year 2002, things, if there's a demand, if we have a decline in requests, then it's a whole different story.
You're saying there's eighth graders now are going to be having problems, and then later years of college, and fourth, fifth graders aren't going to get any.
Well, it'll be a different kind of program in the sense that if you go to strictly bonding, you may have to go on some kind of a need basis or some other kind of, rather than the equity program you have now that's available to all residents.
Well, it's pure arrogance for administration in its first year or two of service to come in and destroy a program that has two decades of effort. That's my opinion. I'll say that to the government. In fact, I will be. Saying it on the record now. Do you have any further comments on your program? You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last time you were before us, I think we asked you what the programs were that which you had for graduate work outside. Could you run through those again?
I'd like to have Diane Behrens, our program
manager. I apologize. You told me this before. I'm just
sorry, she's not.
Diane Behrens, programs coordinator. And you wanted to know the fields that which
right.
he is currently serving?
Right.
They are medicine, dentistry, occupational therapy, optometry, osteopathy, physical therapy, podiatry, and veterinary medicine.
Okay. Over the weekend, we had a Senate Finance Budget Subcommittee in Anchorage with the university budget, and we had a presentation for requesting money for the addition of a social worker, master's degree program in social work. And I've worked with this group, and we've seen this proposal over the years, and they present a pretty good need for in-state social workers. Oh, that's all, that's what, the studies seem to indicate that. So, but we clearly, under this budget scenario, we're not going to embark on trying to get an accredited social work program at the university, and it would literally be, it could be $1 million a year effort to do that for, there's 40 students at least waiting, I know now. That got me thinking again about how often does the post-secondary commission meet and evaluate these witchy fields relevant to in-state Alaska demand, and how do they make those decisions? And I don't want to second guess them, but I mean, what makes occupational therapy or veterinary medicine more important and more worthy of a witchy subsidy than a master's degree in social work?
The witchy commission is made up by members from each of the 14 states that participate in the compact. And for the commission to decide to add a field, either to Group A or Group B, I did a memo that went to the committee indicating that Group A fields were fields in which students could have access to Western Regional Graduate Schools only if they were residents of the state operating the school or if they were witchy certified students, or Group B, which were underserved graduate fields that were present in more, where access was easier within the Western region. In order to add a field to either of those groups, four witchy states have to indicate a need for that particular field. In fact, in the last few years, there have been no additions until 92, 93, when physician's assistants will be added as a Group B field because of the need expressed by four of the different witchy states.
So it's not a unilateral decision.
No.
This is, and no one else has problems training social workers?
Well, actually, I would mention that Witchy administers the Western Regional Graduate Exchange, which is a straight-across exchange where we have graduate fields in Alaska that students from other states come and attend at residence rates, and residents from Alaska can go to these other states and attend graduate fields as well. There is a Master of Social Work at two of the different participating schools within the Western region. However, they're very specifically focused graduate fields. They're Masters of Social Work in, I believe it's rural planning. So these are programs that have been identified by the different universities, and I think in part because the state itself doesn't have the population base to support a graduate program. So by participating in a WICHU program, they can attract students from other states, even if that means allowing them to attend at a resident rate rather than a non-resident rate. So there are a couple of Masters of Social Work programs available to Alaskans, but they do have to leave the state to get them. And they would have to decide that this specialization of social work is what they were truly interested in.
You know, I'm not sure I still understand it.
Well, we used to have a list that we would write that said the following eligibility.
Yeah, why did we do that? Why were we doing that?
I'm sorry, I...
Yeah.
Well, we used to have a list that said, I know I have amended in, yeah. I had a concern like you had. Yeah. I've amended into a list that said the state would support the following group of people, lawyers, social workers, whatever. And primarily, however, the expense of tuition groups that we don't provide for in the state, like doctors, lawyers, and so on. And we had that list that we wrote in the statute, amended a number of times, and that was the one for which the state would support WICHE programs for. And so we met architects in there for a while. And so we thought there was a shortage of varying components in our wisdom. And then they would be eligible for funding if there were funds available. And we allowed you to prioritize. But if there were funds available, they were eligible for funding for out of state in the WICHE group of campuses to go for whatever graduate programs the state of Alaska had agreed would conform or they would supply money for. And say, one year we didn't have architecture, for instance. We probably don't have it again. But we wrote it into that list that we would support students out of this program by funding it to a greater degree than it had been for tuition assistance at, say, the University of Washington, etc.
The selection that
we don't do that anymore?
Well, the selection that you had to choose from were both Group A and Group B fields. And Group B is architecture.
It's a more recent designation. In the old days, it was one listing.
Right, there was. And it was not until states sort of came into this joint budget crisis that...
Okay, now what you're telling us, in Group A, you will fund all Group A's requests before you ever get near a Group B?
Per the 1987 legislative intent language written to the...
My God, I've never seen anybody do that much with intent. Get me that 1987 intent language. We'll take care of it. I mean, as a rule, it's taking statute to make changes.
Well, in the group...
You get me that 97, exactly the intent language you're operating on. I want to see it.
Okay.
Because I'm, you know, I don't argue with you that that's what you're using. Thank God that somebody's using intent once. I mean, it's unique in the annals. And,
well, in fact, I had not seen the language myself. I had sort of been hit this role and been told about it, but I just recently...
It gets down to this. There's always at the Finance Committee level, certainly for the co-chairman, to provide some opportunity during, during a period of tenure to respond to key crises in the areas that he specifically either wishes to hover over or recognizes or in his district, et cetera. And this may well be one. We're not trying to take the medical school students. We're wondering if we don't have one or two other dollars, we ought to add to it instead of some capital project or something else, you know. And that is our responsibility, you know. You propose and we dispose. And I don't like what we've proposed and you've disposed here, so. I've frustrated me before, so you picked right up on something that my memory, I just thought either reverse Alzheimer's or in fact somebody was ignoring what we were doing. Albeit, if you don't provide the money, you can't send the kids to school. But I heard the same testimony that he has, and there's a standing room only in demand and need for the service. Why not supply Alaskans, I suspect.
The one caveat that I would add is simply that the only groups that you can choose from, the only fields that you can choose from, are the ones that WICHE Compact as a whole has agreed to serve within this particular compact.
Why don't we get a list of those, too?
Certainly.
Sure, I understand that. Yes,
sir. Could I get another copy of the letter that you sent?
Yeah.
You said, I haven't seen it, and maybe I've disposed of it.
I better have another copy, too, because I seem to have disposed of it already, too.
They proposed we dispose.
Yeah, we're into it. The circular file is hit. Also, we make a lot of requests, and we forget unless staff writes them down and reminds us. Anyway, Witchy and Whammy are understood. I think that they're important parts of your program. The student scholarship loan's an important part of your program. There's several people beginning to wonder if there are other components of the program that are as necessary as taking that money and funding just the programs you now have. I don't know.
Senator, yes, I think before you get, I'm probably at six of those people, those nine people you're concerned about are tied into the monitoring the financial activity of the loan programs. You're really talking about a couple of us. You're talking about me, which is quite all right, but there aren't a lot of people out there being funded to do
things. The board, where's the board money coming from?
Well, I true, there are a 14-member board. They do travel and meet four times a year.
I understand you have to administer a program.
And somebody, you know, if they're going to be appeals, whether it's a corporation appeal board or a commission appeal board, you will have literally hundreds of people that complain about the fact they didn't get their deferment or they didn't get their loan or they didn't get whatever they got. Somebody's got to sit down and deal with it. Frankly, I'd rather have a large cross-section of Alaskans than just two of us sitting there saying, well, it's you and you and you and you. That's not the role I think the commission particularly wants to fulfill, but it is one of the big functions they do.
And finally, again, you can get the information that the co-chairman wishes, and you can also give us information of what is going to happen to this program with the reluctance of the present administration to continue it. That's my words, but that's what it appears to be. What's going to happen to it when?
It's on paper. We've seen the draft. We're just waiting for the final.
And you're just responding to our request, which at this stage, I don't think there's any negative to doing so. There should not be. Do you have any further questions, Mr. Chairman? Well, it's one of my favorite subjects. Thank you very much for coming.
I hadn't noticed. Thank you, Senator.
Here are three bills, Senate Bill 337 relating to the RIP program, Senate Bill 362 relating to permafund dividend applications and the inclusion of a voter registration form, and Senate Bill 355 extending the Alaska Regional Economic Assistance Program. First bill before us is, I guess, either grandson or great-grandson of RIP, Senate Bill 337. Senator Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure everyone here is familiar with the legislation, at least the previous two bills that passed. There was a third one that just amended the second one, so this is really only the third RIP program. The bill, 337, would establish a retirement incentive program. The basic configuration of the program is substantially similar to previous offerings, with which I think the committee is familiar. Under terms of the bill, a three-year retirement credit will again be offered to qualified individuals to be applied in the following order. First, the 3 years can be used to meet the age or service required for eligibility for normal retirement. Secondly, to meet the age required for early retirement. Third, to reduce the actuarial adjustment required for early retirement. And fourth, as years of credit service for calculating retirement benefits. In order to qualify, an employee must be within 3 years of earlier normal retirement. The increased benefit will vary depending on each individual's length of service, their age, and the retirement system they're in. And the personal service savings required by the program will again be calculated over a five-year period. An important component of the program is that the employee must pay what they would have paid into the retirement system if they continued to work for an additional 3 years. The employer's cost is the difference between the employee's contribution and the full actuarial cost of three-year incentive. So, again, the employee is required to pay in the employee contribution for the 3 years that they would have normally worked. The state's actuaries calculate the full cost of participation for each individual eligible for the program, and this means that all costs incurred because the individual retires 3 years earlier is fully paid in the respective retirement system. If you had a chance to review the 1990 annual reports for both the PERS and the TERS system, they state that systems have been adequately compensated for the retirement incentive program incurred costs. There are, of course, window periods in the legislation for retirement. For teachers, they would apply from June 30th, 1992 through December 31st of 92 and must retire, or can retire, by July 1st and must retire by August 1st of 1993. University has the same window as teachers. For state employees, the application period is July 31st of 92 through October 31st of 92. The first day they can retire is October 1st, 92, and they must retire on or before July 1st, 1993. That's a change from what I originally proposed for state employees, but it's a change that was recommended by the administration. They would like to have the retired people retired by the end of the 93 fiscal year in order to, in at least according to their statement, to maximize the savings in their view as would impact FY94. There is a proposed amendment in your packet that, if adopted, and I will be offering it, would allow all employers other than the state to implement a shorter window period for their employers than for their employees than is in the bill. It wouldn't allow them to expand it, but if they, for some management reasons, would like to shorten the window period and require people to retire earlier, they would be allowed to do that under the amendment that I'll be offering. For example, the Ketchikan School District would like to limit the window period for their teachers to require retirement by August 1st, 1992, and I think that's a local, that should be a local decision. If they would like to do that, they would then have the option of adopting a shorter window period than what we have in the legislation, but not a longer window period. They couldn't expand it, but they could shorten it. And that amendment will allow them and other public employers maximum flexibility to use a program to accommodate their specific budgetary needs. Savings for the original program, the one we passed in 1986, I guess it was, amounted to over $73 million. The legislative auditor's conservative standard for calculating savings and the high level of participation in the original program account for much of the difference between the savings for the 86 and 87 program and 89-90. The 89-90 savings was about $23 million. That was achieved by public employers throughout the state of Alaska. I think the economic benefits of the retirement incentive program are one of its most compelling features. First, personal services savings are realized in operating budgets. Secondly, the new retirees, for the most part, remain in their communities and continue contributing their resources to our economy. And third, the employee with less seniority who is not laid off or is newly hired continues to receive a paycheck and therefore contributes to Alaska's economy. There are some figures out that indicate that the number of retirees remaining in the state has increased in recent years, so more and more people are remaining in the state. The committee substitute that we passed out of state affairs, you're familiar with, Mr. Chairman. We adopted three amendments that the administration had recommended. We've also got in the legislation some language that was recommended by our legislative auditors that should help develop and implement a method of documenting in the governor's annual budget request the net reduction in personal services costs for each agency that adopts a retirement incentive plan. And so that was in response to the legislative auditor's findings, and the audit is also in your packet. That's a brief overview. I do have the one amendment that I would like to offer at some time. I know there's also a technical amendment that your staff has found on the title that needs to be changed. It may not need to be changed, but it's a technical amendment. And I think I have been given a copy of an amendment from Senator Petula, and we have reviewed that amendment and have no problem with it. I don't believe the administration has any difficulty with it.
We don't have
I brought this up. I'm not sure Senator Petula wants to offer it, but it was sent down to my office. And I
guess I ought to see it again.
Okay.
Another.
But I didn't want it to be overlooked. I wasn't necessarily going to offer it, but it was one of Senator Petula.
Senator Petula, if you intended to offer it, maybe we could get some
copies.
Yeah,
we have to.
We don't. The members don't have that in their packets.
Questions?
Are there questions for bill sponsor, Senator Adams?
Going on to the fiscal note, it has six positions in there. Why is the fiscal note going beyond the particular RIP program?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a question that's better responded to by the division, Mr. Stallnaker.
We also have, maybe if both or all representatives from the Department of Administration could come forward, Mr. Stallnaker, as well as, is there Mr. Waney or Wani? I think there were a couple of different fiscal notes, and maybe this would be a good time just to explain the fiscal notes and how the chargeback would work and what the reason for the new positions are. If you could identify yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Stallnaker, Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
My name is Don Wani. I'm Director of the Division of Finance.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, in response to your question, the fiscal note addresses during the RIP period, which is 2 years on this one, 3 years the second RIP, and the window period was even larger in the first RIP. We're in a more condensed period of time for this RIP. We're projecting the number of people over the next 2 years that's equivalent to the number of people we have for the second RIP. We are proposing that six of those positions remain permanent and continue on for a number of reasons. First of all, the issue has come up in other committee hearings about the number of retirement legislations, the fine-tuning, if you will, of several bills, of changes in the system that by themselves have not been sufficient to warrant, first of all, showing a specific cost, secondly, showing the amount of extra work that would be involved in implementing these types of changes. A bill like this gives us an opportunity to recognize the impact of the changes that the systems have gone through from several different sources. One, from not only statutory changes that have occurred over the last 10 years, federal regulation changes that have occurred over the last 10 years, changes in demographics of the system brought on by certainly the prior RIP bills as well as other changes that have occurred. We propose the continuation of these as permanent positions because the demographics of the system have changed and have increased the amount of participation both in employers in the PERS by over 50% increase over the last 5 years, to retirees, which have had over 100% increase in the last 5 years, and would allow us to provide a minimum level of continued service for those people. The second reason is when we have non-permanent positions trying to do the work necessary of the RIP, we estimate it takes 2 to 3 months to train a person. And we find that generally, more often than not, we go through an extended period of time of training and the person accepts a permanent position elsewhere and we have to start all over and get another non-perm to train. This would provide us with the opportunity during the RIP period that would give us an opportunity to keep well-trained people and provide the incentive to keep them, while still acknowledging that we can review it after a couple years, and certainly if it's deemed that those positions are not necessary to keep as permanent, we can get rid of them. I've got some statistics that will explain the growth in the systems. As I said, the systems have increased by over 50% in the number of employers in the PERS. The number of physical activity that's gone on is over into the 200% increase of address changes, of telephone, of communication, of correspondence. All this is the result of increase in membership, which is promoted by certainly accelerated turnover, but by just natural growth of the systems. With the retirement systems, when you cut state government, it doesn't cut the job that we have to do. These people stay on. Whether they're retired, deferred, vested, or active, they're still our responsibility. And what this fiscal note tries to do is acknowledge the fact that one, managerially, gives us a better tool to keep our non-permanent people. And secondly, recognizes the fact that due to these types of changes, that the system grows and our responsibilities grow, and the employers are already paying for these costs. These costs are considered in the actuarial assumptions as an offset against the earnings. We've been experiencing actuarial growth. The value of the assets have increased by 80% in the last 5 years, with the administrative costs for management of the system itself not increasing. And this recognizes some of that.
Senator Adams.
Yes. This is the third RIP bill. And it's supposed to show a savings, which we have audit numbers. Do you think that with the decline of the revenues that we can take advantage of the RIP program when we need to cut perhaps between 1,000 and 2,000 state employees, perhaps through decrease of the operating budget?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, certainly that's the issue of the value of the RIP program. I think what our numbers demonstrate is that there is express savings. What the audit from legislative audit shows is that there are savings that the employers are recognizing and that those savings are being passed on either to continue to provide current level of service or cutting back on positions if the employers desire to. We also recognize that there are some employers that don't participate in the RIP because they don't personally feel that they can experience a savings. The bill is a bill that puts it up to the employer's option if they feel they can demonstrate a savings. So in that respect, as a tool for the employer, I think it does its job.
Then in this piece of legislation, you must demonstrate the savings.
Yes, sir.
What happens in Section 8, here you got the director of the courts, where you cannot demonstrate a savings?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, I think the way that we interpret the bill, they would have to show a savings.
Without him, if they don't
show a savings, I would say you're right. If they don't show a savings, it would seem to me the director of the court system couldn't participate.
Do you find that once you go into a RIP program, that you're out of the state system, that we have employees coming back into the system through a state contract? Isn't that not what this particular program was? Once you get ripped out of the state employment, that you're gone, but yet we have people coming back and then getting a state contract on the side?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, I think that's exactly right. The intent of the program is to provide a disincentive for employees to come back to work, which it does. It provides a penalty, in fact. We recommended an amendment and was adopted in state affairs to put the prohibition against a person coming back under contract for the period of a year. We've actually not found a large number of cases where even without this prohibition they came back under contract, but there are some cases. We think that the way the bill currently exists with that provision in there, it would continue to discourage you.
Senator Adams.
One final question then. If this is a savings and we show that in 1 year we saved $73 million and $23 million, what do you estimate the next savings going to be on this particular program? Can you make a guesstimate utilizing the first two RIP bills?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, I really couldn't guess.
Okay. Then would it be fair to say that perhaps there would be intent language placed someplace in the budget that the savings occurred by this can take care of any state employee that has COLA or a merit increase?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, I really can't respond to that question.
Thank you.
Senator Duncan and then Senator Petula.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of points on the questions that Senator Adams was asking. First of all, the question about with declining revenues, do we expect that this program will work? Let me just respond and say that probably during a period of tightening revenues, declining revenues, where you're looking at reducing the budget, this is when the program works the best. It's when it makes it the most useful because it's a management tool to bring about those reductions. In fact, one of the reasons perhaps in 86 why we saw such a large number of savings, despite the fact that it was the first time out and there was a large pool of people, is we were also in a period of time of declining revenues and government was being forced to shrink back. So I think it probably works better in a period of declining revenues than it does in a period of growth because there's more incentive to reduce government, therefore more incentive for people to retire. Just that general comment. There was one other one I can't recall.
Court system.
Oh, the court system. The court system point. That was not asked for in the legislation by Mr. Stalnaker or the department. I put that provision in the original legislation. The department administration hasn't had any objection throughout the committee process to that provision being in there because the bottom line is that if it doesn't save money, the director of the court system will not be able to take the retirement incentive program provisions. He can only retire, use the RIP provisions, if it saves the court system money, just as that's the case with anyone else. And the reason why we have to set this out separately is it's a separate retirement system. He's in a judicial retirement system, and he's the only one in that retirement system who could even possibly participate in the RIP program. That's why it has to be designated separately in the legislation. But the bottom line with that position, as well as with any position in state government, our teacher, university, or municipal, is it has to save money. So putting this in here doesn't give the director of the court system a right to retire or to use retirement incentive program. It just makes it available for the saves money.
Senator Petula.
In a wry comment, I'm not sure that I endorse this amendment, but I'm sure that the retirement of that individual, as long as he couldn't come back on contract for an extended period of time, would probably save money all right there. Save the general fund money. just have that strong suspicion it may not save the department money. In fact, it might be the reverse. There's two asides here. One, yesterday's or day before, as time leaves me, but anyway, the testimony in the questioning back and forth between the Commissioner of Public Safety and some of the senators, including the author, leads me to feel that we need a strong intent in this legislation to inform all the administrators of the varying departments that this is not mandatory, that this is a administrative management decision in each and every case, because the commissioner did not know that. I forget it myself, and I think they need to be informed in some very instructive way that well, I don't say that we should suggest that in a positive, directive way, that it's intent. But I think that we need to have this notification that administrators just don't seem to have out in the field and right at the commissioner level, even, to wit, yesterday's conversations and discussions. But I'd like to see an intent in there informing them that the final decisions, of course, are up to the administrators of the varying departments in these cases, so that they full well know that they don't have to let go a key employee, which I experienced a very negative impact in highways, small off-system roads. We didn't have the engineering staff that was trained to build these roads at anything like a competitive price after we retired a few people out of DOT. Amazing. There's nobody else left in this state. Sometimes it's a very small state to do this work.
Those were those dinosaurs that your colleague was talking about?
Yeah, varying dinosaurs that build small roads that had an economical... anyway, that intent... The other thing that is triggered to me is to Mr. Greeney. I want to know what the liabilities the state has, again, on the retirement funds. And I know we're setting up a separate board, so I suspect they're somewhat less when you get more and more user management. If you have rapid declines in the value of the stock portfolio and the interest return for supporting retirements, and you have a net decline that's significant and may put you out of actuarial balance in a significant way for any retirement programs, where does the state come in and have a liability for that kind of a exercise, that kind of an experience? We know what happened to SBS here. We probably felt we didn't have, in that case, a liability. We had something moral more than legal, maybe, but we picked it up, $120 million. I'm still concerned about rapid impact. Even though today it looks real good, I'm always concerned about the value of that portfolio and how it may affect later draw on the Treasury to put it back into some actuarial balance. That's the thing that I don't thoroughly understand.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if this topic comes up so often, and we have a number of retirement bills coming, I know, from state affairs here sooner or later. Mr. Stalnaker, the actuary that we employ, is he a state employee, or is he on contract, or is he available to us? Would that be worthwhile to invite a representative of the Department of Administration and the actuary and maybe somebody from revenue to, hopefully in as simple terms as possible, talk about how the predictions are made, what the factors are, what accounts for some of the ups and downs and actuarial soundness of PERS, TERS, whatever funds being utilized?
Mr. Chairman, the system actuary is under contract with the William M. Mercer Incorporated. I think that's certainly an excellent idea. We could make arrangements at your convenience to have him come up from Seattle to make a presentation before the committee. And
Is he scheduled to come up anytime in the next?
Actually, yes. The Mr. Chairman, the first weekend in May. We have a... First weekend in April.
Yeah. We're a little busy that weekend.
A little busy that time, I'm sorry. Yeah. First weekend in April. The first weekend in April, or first week in April, when we have our spring board meetings, he'll be scheduled to be in town. But he could certainly also come up before that time at your convening.
Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's probably worth doing to have that discussion, but I wanted to be sure that again, as we start talking about retirement bills, that the actuary did a report last year. It was transmitted in April of 1991, I guess was the most recent report done. And there was an increase in contribution, a decrease in funding ratio, an increase in contribution rate for the teacher's retirement system. However, as you read that actuarial report, you find that that increase came about because of legislation passed in 1990 that gave an automatic post-retirement pension adjustment the primary reason. On the other hand, you'll find for the PRS system, public employees retirement system, that the contribution rate actually went down slightly. And that went down even though we had enacted two previous retirement saving programs. That retirement, contribution went down, and the funding is still at 97.2 or something. It's very, very high. The point I'm trying to make is the actuaries say very clearly the retirement incentive programs do not have any impact on the actuarial soundness of the funds, have not had any impact. They're fully funded programs, employee contribution, employer contribution. I don't think it's wrong for us, however, to have the actuaries here to have an overview on the funds and understand what's happening.
Yes,
but to tie it to this legislation is
I was going to say that this is a larger issue, and I actually wasn't thinking so much of this legislation, but we've had questions on the TERS money going up. I think at the same time it's probably helpful maybe to incorporate an SBS overview as far as how those monies are being invested, what's happening to them. You know, maybe somebody from the Attorney General's office who's working on the SBS might be a good opportunity if the members are willing to kind of have a more generalized overview of what goes into the retirement systems and how the earnings affect contribution rates. Just
Mr. Chairman, I tend to learn by the lecture method anyway. After years of school, I still write notes. If I'm paying attention, I learn a great deal. Again, the question I never really had answered at any time satisfied me is not how it's doing today. It's what are if some of these other implications, what goes up comes down, and certainly our investments are going up and down in a given period of time, they'll come way down. I'd like to get a feeling, especially now that we're transferring from a total administrative responsibility, there may be people that are making decisions that don't work in the state, that have a call somehow in the state treasury by virtue of whether their investments are the people they've hired to make investments and so on. But I think that's an area that it's well worth our while looking at, apart from anything we're doing here. It's just something that this triggers and has triggered before. The Senator and I have had some rancorous debate on this before.
But, rancorous, I wouldn't call it rancorous.
Whatever it was. I listen and you talk, let's put that. And,
but I wasn't rancorous.
Whatever.
But I think it is advisable. If we don't have any problems at any time, smooth. If we do, but it has nothing to do with the concern with the drawdown here or the contribution. It's just what happens. And every now and then it strikes me, and it's been bothering me for a couple of weeks. And I think it's time to put it to rest with those of us that.
I share your. Learning mode. I've been, as you know, deep into the retirement system investment problem. I've looked at the reports. I don't understand the reports. It's for me, too. I think it's more helpful to be able to ask people questions in person and try to get an oral presentation in addition to the written material that we do have.
And you can kind of present to him those things up front so he can prepare for them. Where are we if something happens to the value of that portfolio, essentially?
Well, we'll work with you, Mr. Stalnaker, in trying to set up a future meeting here. And I see my staff person just walked in. I'm sure she'll be following up with you on the details. Senator Duncan.
And just one other comment on a different topic. Senator Kakuda's first statement about the letter of intent to the administration so that they understand this program. I guess a letter of intent's okay, except it says in the bill very clearly how the program's to work if they just read the bill, one. And secondly, I'm sure the retirement division of retirement benefits have informed past commissioners and one form of these commissioners it's an optional program. The commissioner who was before us yesterday, of course, wasn't around when the other programs were in effect, although his right-hand man who was sitting at the table sure there was, and they understood the program then, just as they should have understood it now. But, you know, I don't know how you ever, people can't read bills, even they can't read letters of intent probably, so I think we're going to have to rely upon the administration to inform the commissioner very clearly that it's optional.
It may well be that we should just direct the a one-liner said essentially what the senator says. Reading such and such a section and sending out a notation to every one of the management group in advance so that they do know, we have a whole bunch of new commissioners and a lot of new employees that may not understand. And again, we may be just that one and maybe an incidental. I don't know. I just don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I might add to maybe clarify our position in all this.
Please come forward.
As with all the employers, the Division of Retirement Benefit doesn't propose to the employers how they should participate. And certainly the administration or the state generally coordinates through the Office of Management and Budget on how they particularly participate in the program. I think it's always been accepted in the past in the prior two RIFs that it was a mandatory.
Well, maybe they learned by the lecture method also.
Commissioner Usera, did you have comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize I wasn't here at the beginning, but as a matter of fact, we were in a cabinet meeting discussing this very issue. At about 9:05,
what was the vote? What was the vote?
Well, let's say that there is a reluctant acceptance that in fact, and which has been my testimony certainly in the Senate State Affairs Committee, that we believe that we can manage this program too effectively do two things. Number one, achieve some savings for the state in terms of helping us reduce workforce, and at the same time, at a time that we have to be of paramount importance in maintaining stability in the economy, can in fact have people moving out of the system who have adequate income to be able to support themselves and don't end up on the health and social services roll. The key to it, as Senator Petula so aptly put, is management. And that is that we manage this program. And I would say that I think that we can step up to the challenge and make this program work. One of my observations has been, and certainly I wasn't here during the last two programs, but the programs were enacted at a time where the administration was turning over. So the same people who supported the program initially were not the people who ultimately were implementing the program. And I think that that one leg up that we have in making this a successful program is that if it's put into place now, we've got 2 years to make this thing work, or as Senator Duncan has been so willing to help us on this, we're putting in a shortened window that makes us step up to the challenge, make the decisions. This isn't going to drag on and on forever. This is a make a decision, make it work, and then move on. Certainly there are some costs associated with it, but I can tell you that not everyone on the cabinet is wild about this idea. For the very same reasons that we hear this debate around the table. Does it really work? I think we can make it work. It is, you know, management is a very difficult thing to do. We all want to be nice guys. You know, we don't want to have to make some of the tough choices. And it makes us unpopular. You know, does it create morale problems inside the department? What if we say yes, you can, and no, you can't? That goes with the territory. And I think that those are the things that we have to step up to that. And you know, as I said to my colleagues, you know, I think we should accept this challenge and make this thing work, because I think that it can certainly assist us in the year ahead. I guess the short term we'll see.
Senator Cardullo.
You're in a double difficult situation, of course, because in the pure business world, the bottom line will make you do things. That gives you the discipline. You're in a political system which pressures on you are not unlike those on us. So you have that added. You have to really have the capacity to manage.
Agreed.
I think you do. So
I didn't say it was going to be easy. Well,
you know, the last one out, turn off the lights.
I didn't figure I was in this for popularity content.
Senator Duncan.
Thank you. Well, Commissioner, I appreciate your testimony, and I didn't realize you folks were discussing this topic this morning, but I appreciate that also. And a couple of the concerns that were expressed around here. One is, I think it is a good management tool. It's worked in the past, and it can work this time. And it seems to me the program was the most successful in 86, when there was a period of time of tightening revenues, declining revenues, and government was in a period of reduction. And this may be where we're at again. At least it appears we are. So it's a management tool that can be successful. I think it can work. The discussion that was maybe you picked up on as you came in was that at least one commissioner had testified that he thought that once this passed, he had to let everybody retire who became eligible, but he was going to lose 133 people or whatever it was, or 90-some people. Is it clear in your mind that the commissioners, as well as local municipalities and school districts and university, it's optional? I mean, not every department, for example, in the first program, the core system didn't participate at all. They just opted out of the program. And so it's possible that organizational units could decide not to participate if they think it's not to their benefit. And of course, even once they decide to participate, if an employee is deemed eligible, it doesn't mean that employee gets to retire. You or the manager makes that tough decision.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, I can say that certainly on the cabinet there is a much clearer understanding now than there was an hour ago that in fact that is the case. I don't know that there is a general understanding of the rules, and I think that certainly it was made apparent to me that perhaps we need to do a better job together of educating both my colleagues and the municipalities and the other political subdivisions that are subject to this bill on really what those options are. I think that in a simple reading of the bill, it isn't clear that it is management's option and that those units can be broken down as small as individuals in terms of making this program work. I think there seems to be a fair amount of flexibility. And certainly for my part, I will be sure that we get some, as a matter of fact, it was requested and I committed to the cabinet that we would give them some of the overview and the parameters of how this will work really, or how we can make it work as a good management tool. So up to this point, I don't think that there was a common understanding. Now, we also have not, I would have to tell you that we've not taken it on, we the Department of Administration for Retirement and Benefits have not taken it on as our mission to educate the political subdivisions with regard to the implications of this bill.
Sure. And I understand that. I don't really think you need to. We'd hope. I mean, they've been through this before, and I have been correspondent with someone who've been misinformed, and I'm trying to educate them, too. I hate to use that term. I'm trying to inform them of how it works. But I think together we can do that. And I think that the School Board Association is very capable of informing the districts how it works, and NEA is aware of it, and Municipal League, et cetera. So I think that will... we can overcome that. I guess the reason why I asked that question is we suggested we do a letter of intent explaining to the commissioners how the program works. And I don't think that does any good either. I think it's going to have to be a one-on-one situation with commissioners and so on.
Senator Curtula?
Well, Finance Committee, I suppose, can write a letter statewide to varying institutions or the administration. I agree, they can read the bill, and maybe that's all that they should be informed of, but I'm not sure that they shouldn't fully aware of the impacts. Something about, maybe it's just the district I represent, and I know they don't know. I knew yesterday a commissioner didn't know, and that's what triggered this whole response. This is a matter of social conscience here, and that is that when you're having a reduction, or you may have a reduction in staff as a result of declining revenues, and that's not approaching other resource revenues at this time, or other tax available. So we are doing this to help people out in a whole number of ways, and it speaks to a broad social conscience that doesn't stand people in line under a need-based system. I support that very strongly as a methodology. I still have tingling in the back, so you don't vote yellow or blue or green or park for it. You've got to vote yes or no on these subjects. A negative aspect still comes from a haunting memory of a very strong, very able, democratic businessman who is and very successful, who said to me, there's no way that a 40-year-old, 17 years of service, or even 20 years of service to the state, the nation, the business community, can really engender enough to support his retirement for the next 40 years. That's always a concern. It's just a little part of what haunts me in these things. As I say, I'm for it because of the social implications, but I'm concerned about the fact that how much time and effort and space should you make as a contribution before you're really entitled to a retirement. And that is, that haunts, I think, everybody that deals with this subject a little bit, and should, no matter what figures are in a particular system.
I would yield, Bob.
Yes, yes, yes. No,
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Senator, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the you know, the social aspect, and I don't mean this to sound cruel and hard and uncaring, but the fact is it's an advantageous byproduct of this. You know, I'm looking at this as a tool, and it's good for us too. And it's good for us being able to get some of the things done that we need to do. But I would also like to reinforce your comment that I don't think that as a general rule that we want to support public policy that rushes through the system. And same testimony made at Senate State Affairs. You know, there is an investment in these employees. And the fact is that management looks to that investment. We've put a lot of money into training. We've put a lot of money into benefits and their investment in the system. And I think that we are not fulfilling our fiscal responsibility if we move people out before we've gotten an adequate return on that investment. There are, in fact, a number of programs where I think that we do ourselves a disservice. You know, when we look at retirement programs, they are designed to attract and retain qualified employees for the state. And, you know, we have registered 1,500 names on it. You know, this isn't a problem. We're not in a position.